Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and happiness is the topic this hour of the show. Happiness on the planet, happiness in the workplace, happiness in our lives. Our guest is going to be part of an interesting summit next week in Madison, Leadership for a Better World Global Summit, June 17, June 18. It's a leadership conference that looks at the interconnected and complex social, ecological, and economic challenges of organizations and communities. Our guests this hour are part of that summit. They are happiness leaders and researchers. Nick Marks is a statistician from Great Britain. He is founder of the Center for Well-Being at the UK think tank New Economics Foundation. And he's been measuring national well-being and the Happiness Planet Index, promoting a policy that puts the well-being of people and the planet first. He says we can't just look at money because that doesn't always determine happiness. Jen Lim will join us later in the hour, CEO and Chief Happiness Officer of Delivering Happiness, a company that she and the CEO of Zappos.com created in 2010 to inspire happiness in work, community, and everyday life. So Nick is with us the first part of the program here, and we're going to welcome phone calls as well. We're looking at happiness on so many levels. He has looked at happiness country by country, happiness on the planet, and tracks national well-being against resource use because he says that a happy planet doesn't have to cost the earth. And it's interesting what country he, when he's done this research, has determined to be the most happy place in the world. It makes you just want to go there. Not necessarily to live there, but at least go and see what's going on. Our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Nick, thank you very much for being with us. He's joining us. You're in Oslo, Norway.
Hi.
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What are you doing in Oslo?
Oh, I live here partly. My wife lives here, so I'm between the UK and Norway.
Wow. So you're all over the world, sir.
Sometimes I am, yes.
Yeah. I was listening to a talk you did for TED, a TED talk, and it was really interesting. You were looking at planet well-being and country well-being. But you talk about the fact that so many of us think that our future is going to be a nightmare, everything, you know, environmental disaster, future worst-case scenario, that we don't make it. But that what we need to do is change, that we freeze if we think about that, that we need to change the way that we think in terms of what might make us happier as a planet. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, it is. I'm very interested that most sort of popular films and books around the future tend to be quite apocalyptic and not very hopeful. And what does that say about our culture now? And, you know, I grew up with the threat of nuclear war and, you know, mass destruction in that way. And I think the younger generation are growing up with a feeling that, you know, the world is going to ecologically disintegrate, and it's like that's not a very hopeful image. And it's like, how can we do things to, yes, you know, notice that things are you know, we do have issues like climate change, we do have issues like local environmental degradation, but how we can create a future that's good for us all. Really, that's my sort of thing that gets me out of bed in the morning, thinking about those sort of issues.
What have you done when you've put together this index, this Planet Happiness Index? What is it, Nick?
Yeah, well, really it's tackling economics, because economics thinks that more GDP, more income per household income is the outcome indicator of, like, that's life going well. And it's not that money isn't important, but it's economics making the goal in its own terms. And I think economics should be heard to account by other judgments, other views. And the best thing to do is to ask people themselves about how their lives are going. We now have the sort of methodologies to ask large populations about how lives are going on their own terms, not what economists think, whether they've got a good life or not. and it produces quite a different answer. So really, I would say the outcome for a nation, the ultimate outcome is how happy people are and how long they live, because people want to live a full life and they want to live a good life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the outcome. But we have to also just watch out for, you know, basically the fundamental input, which is actually how much of the planet do we chew up to produce those lives. And I think that's where you start introducing an interesting efficiency idea, that the metric, the indicator, the numbers of the future should be about good lives that don't cost the Earth. And that's really what the Happy Planet Index is about.
You made a suggestion, which I thought, wouldn't this change everything if we included this in our daily radio broadcasts? You always hear, everybody does, the Dow Jones is up, it's down, it's, you know, the economic index is whatever, and it kind of goes in, for me, one ear and out the other most days. But what if we, in Great Britain or in the United States or in other countries, said energy usage today in the United States was da-da-da-da, and that is down from yesterday or up from yesterday, and compare it to last year? Wouldn't that change the way that we used energy?
I really do think it would do. It's like, I think we need very timely data, very almost real-time data on energy use. And it's obviously a long-term change we're talking about. And, you know, the people that you can learn from in this are people like sports psychologists and athletes who, you know, they might have a long-term goal to get a gold medal or something, but they're looking at their training times each week and how they're doing. And we need to create indicators that start to give us that. And so, you know, we're a Wednesday today in June. You know, how are we doing a Wednesday in June last year? You know, are we 1% down on our carbon budget or whatever it is? And I think people could start to buy into that. And I actually think that most of the population really don't give, monkeys about the Dow Jones Index or how the dollar is doing compared to the euro or whatever else you report on. I think it would be much more meaningful. And there are small things that we can do ourselves, and there are big things that, you know, nations and governments and businesses can do. So, you know, it's trying to create a common goal. That's really the purpose of it. And to me, that goal should be, you know, getting more good lives for less resource use.
Mm-hmm. And it would also make you take some action, that maybe you would do something then, if I do this, the situation might be better. So I'm going to turn off the lights, or I'm going to, you know, make sure that I walk instead of riding a car. You start thinking about all you can do as a human being.
Yeah, you do. And I think we are, you know, humans are creatures that like to, keep up with our neighbors and things like that. And so there's quite a lot of research in something which is generally called behavioral economics, but it's sort of behavioral psychology, really, that if you sort of tell people, you know, that their energy bill is in the highest 20% in their neighborhood, people will start to look across at their neighbors and start thinking, oh, I could be saving more money and I could be doing this. And so there are sort of nudges, people call it sometimes, you know, about how you can start to influence people's behavior without telling them what to do, but to sort of motivate them to be greener in a way. And I mean, the problem we often have is that actually the environmentally friendly choice is the most expensive choice, which is ridiculous, really. You know, the environmentally friendly choice should be the cheapest choice, and then people would move towards it naturally, because, you know, we need these short-term motivations, and money is associated with that. So, you know, we need to change the incentive structure sometimes around how people behave, because, you know, we want to be noble, but, you know, all of us, you know, we get tired on a Friday and we don't do the things
right.
We should do. And it's like we have to be realistic about how humans actually act.
Yeah. All right, now take in, you're talking about countries that are happy enough, at least, or have enough food and have enough sleep and perhaps have enough work and health to be able to live semi-happy lives. Let's switch to those countries that you make mention of, sub-Saharan Africa, where the average life is 43 years. Malaria, HIV, AIDS is killing a lot of people. How do we take that into account when we look at a happy planet?
Basically, in the Happy Planet Index, there's two big factors. There's how well people's lives are doing now and how much resources they're using. So places like sub-Saharan Africa, you know, they're not using so many resources per capita, but they're not delivering good lives. And they're not to be held up as an example, you know, just, you know, as where we should be aiming for. So, you know, we have some rich countries like the USA and the UK and others that producing relatively good lives. I mean, I think they could still be better, actually, but they are. But we're using a lot of resources, and we're not a good example either. So you have to look for the countries that are producing good lives and not using too many resources. So Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, and some other places, you know, where there's you know, great poverty and great hardship, and you know that they're not delivering on the creating good lives part of the metric, if you like.
Mm-hmm. The country, and I hadn't really thought about this, you mentioned this, the happiest nation on the planet, incredible percent of electricity is coming from renewable sources. They'll be carbon neutral soon. They abolished the army in 1949 and invested in social programs. Kind of makes you want to go to this country, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Are you going to name it or me?
I just thought we ought to wait. So, no, I want you to name it. You did the work on it. What is it?
So the country that comes top of the Happy Planet Index is Costa Rica.
Isn't that something?
You know, and it's very interesting when you look at the statistics of it, which is that actually average life expectancy in Costa Rica is higher than the USA.
Goodness gracious.
And that's such a hard, you know, that's a tough statistic, you know, World Health Authority statistic. And they live longer on average than people in the USA. They are happier than people in the USA on average. And they use a quarter of the resources per capita that people do in the USA.
Wow. What are you doing in Oslo? What am I doing in Milwaukee?
I mean, the point really is that we can't move there. You know, right. They've got a population and it's their culture, their language, their space. But there are things to learn from them,
yes.
You know. And yes, they definitely have an environmental advantage. You know, a few countries have this where they have a lot of hydroelectricity. So they have a lot of potential to reduce their carbon footprint. You know, there are other examples of that. Iceland has geothermal energy, you know, where they have the volcanoes sort of water, you know, that can heat. You know, Norway, the country that I'm in at the moment, has a lot of hydro. Chile has a lot of hydro. So there are some countries with some advantages. So we have to recognize that. But Costa Rica have systematically, you know, had a strong environmental policy for a long time. But it's not to say that Costa Rica is a paradise, right? It's got rising inequalities, it's got rising crime, and there are all sorts of ways that its indicators are not moving in the best direction. It's also actually got a rising ecological footprint.
Hmm.
So it's not perfect, but it does come out strongly on top of the Happy Planet Index, and you know, really by quite a long way. And it's very interesting.
Mm. So as a planet, as we look at the issue of climate change and we start to put in policies in effect in the United States or in China or wherever it's going to be to reduce our carbon footprint, which it sounds to me like we have to do, how do we deal as a planet with this disparity between those who have everything and those who would like to have as much as those who have everything have? How do we level everything? How do we get the rich countries to not be as concerned about having more and more and more and more? And what do we do about the poorer countries, the disparity?
You know, it's interesting how you frame that question, because you said, you know, the people that have everything and the people that have nothing. And what is it that they have, you know? And then you immediately made the assumption that it was about money.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, what happens if someone has a great relationship, they've got a great marriage, they've got great relationships with their kids, they've got great relationships in their community, they're doing work that is meaningful and fulfilling to them. Do they not have everything?
Yes, they do.
And that's the point, really, is that it's not the Mercedes. It's not the huge house. And it, after a stage, really, I mean, I'm not an advocate of poverty. I'm not an advocate of misery or anything like that. But after a stage, really, the quality of our life comes down mainly to our relationships, mainly to what we find, you know, interesting and purposeful, what we're curious about. You know, these are the things that actually really fulfill human beings. And they don't have to cost the earth, and they don't have to cost a lot of money. You know, and you know, most of us who are of a certain age have sort of figured out that more money is just going to bring us a bigger car and a bigger house and a few more holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it does bring status, and we are a little bit status driven. You know, we like to be doing well. But it's like, can we sort of reframe what status is? Can we reframe what a good life is into something that is non-materialistic? Because there's absolutely no way that everyone who is working hard in South Korea, in Thailand, in Indonesia, in Africa, in, you know, South America, can have a Mercedes and a huge car and a condo by the beach. It's just not going to work. So we have to reframe what we think the good life is. And I just think the good life should be, you know, us enjoying the fruits of our labor rather than just working hard for more money.
I'm with you. Let's welcome phone calls, and we're also going to welcome, actually, the two of our guests are going to be at this conference that we told you about next week in Madison. Nick Marks is a recognized expert in the field of well-being research, and he does it in a very interesting way. So he's looking at the ecological footprint and looking at how we perhaps need to envision a society that is moving toward a better, happier planet rather than being gloom and doom about where it is that we are heading. Another thing, that if we look at happiness, at personal happiness, we may find that really if you have enough money to get by, is that really what makes people happy? What makes people happy and subsequently the planet happy, and what our national goals should be and how we reach those kinds of goals. A happy planet will take into account our ecological footprint. So that's what we're talking about. And he's going to be in Madison next week. We'll tell you more about that. Another guest joining us momentarily, the CEO and Chief Happiness Officer of Delivering Happiness, Jen Lim. Jen is going to be at that Madison conference, and she has interesting stories about company happiness. A lot of us spend a lot of hours on the job. What is it that corporations, companies can do to allow the people who work for those places to be happy, and how she found happiness in her life as well? So we'll chat with her and welcome phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jen Lin is going to join us for a little while. We're going to be welcoming phone calls here too, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Jen is the CEO and Chief Happiness Officer of Delivering Happiness. How do we create and inspire happiness in work and in community and in everyday life? She created in 2005 the first culture book for Zappos, which is now on its 7th edition, has produced them ever since. And she's going to be at the conference that we told you about at the beginning of the program today. Jen, thank you so much for being with us. And you and Nick know each other, right?
We actually do. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, we met a few years ago at a TED conference, actually.
Oh, great. So you're concerned, and you're doing a great deal to help people find happiness and companies find happiness. I was listening to your TED talk and found it very interesting that it very much was a personal journey for you. You had three things you thought were going to make you happy in your life, and you've gone in another direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a very personal one, and especially since if you had asked me, you know, growing up or a few years ago even, I wouldn't have even predicted that I'd be doing what I'm doing right now, just in the sense I wasn't that happy-go-lucky child growing up in school. I was the one sitting in the back of the room listening to my Walkman, to songs by The Cure or Depeche Mode, you know, reading existential books and really asking all these questions that essentially in a very serendipitous way that this topic of happiness and specifically the science of happiness is addressing in a way that can be meaningful and applicable to so many lives and companies.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. What about companies? Are companies tuned into employees' happiness, do you think? Is it first and foremost on the minds of people who are running corporations?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, and as I mentioned, you know, this book, Delivering Happiness, was launched 2010, and I really thought it was just, you know, checking it off the list of things to do, and that would be done with. But what was unexpected was this whole, it's kind of funny to say, but a global demand for happiness, which is essentially why we decided to evolve into a company. So that was extremely unpredicted, and the fact that we even exist, and half of our clients are outside of the U.S., which is even more surprising to me. But it's the fact that companies more and more so are seeing the economic value of happiness. And so whether you call it happiness or employee engagement or retention, you can use more traditional terms as well. But I think the realization is that companies are knowing that if they don't do something to address this whole concept, whether you call it happiness, well-being, or something else, then pretty much it's not a matter of a nice to have. It's a matter of an extinction for companies that don't know what to do with, you know, engagement and culture. So I would say in the last few years, a lot more companies, and even in the C-level and Fortune 500 to 100, are really turning on, pumping up the volume on what this actually means and how do you implement it and sustain it over time.
And you know the kind of work that Nick is doing. Is there a tie-in to this planet happiness? So in order for people working for corporations to feel somewhat happy, they have to be tied into a larger picture as well, thinking about the ecological footprint, thinking about what a company can do to help achieve a goal of a happy planet by 2050 and lessening our carbon footprint?
Yeah, actually, we're working with Nick quite a bit just because of this whole, it started from him on the happy planet side, but he shifted gears to the happy workplace side. So he's actually producing a lot and creating a lot of tools and surveys that we as a company that's consulting with other companies are able to actually use to be able to measure it. And that's huge for us in the sense of we really want to take the fluff out of happiness. And so in the sense that even the biggest naysayers, CEO, let's say, can't say nay anymore just because what we're showing is the correlation of happiness in employees to hardcore metrics of productivity, engagement, and ROI. So, yeah, we are working a lot together and being more specific of if this, you know, huge planet of ours, if most of us are working and the fact that Gallup, 2012, they took a poll that 87% of this world workforce feels disengaged from their everyday work. It's a real problem. And what we want to do is take a positive spin about it and how do we address and work on the things that's, you know, right with us and positive with us instead of focusing what's wrong with us.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. We have a number of people who would like to join our conversation with both of you and start with Fawn in Madison. Hi, Fawn. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Happy to be on your show. I'd like to just comment on what your first guest was talking about. It sounded so. The gist of what he's saying is to cultivate contentment. I recently had a spiritual mandate given to me to cultivate contentment in my life. And when you look at happiness, as he's describing, divided by the amount of resources that it takes or that go into one's life that in which one can find happiness, couldn't that be a definition of contentment, of that quotient? Mm. Happiness divided by resources. And if that's the most ecological, ecologically sustainable and positive way to orient our society, why not shoot for that?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Nick?
Yeah, I had a bit of trouble hearing her, but I think she said she was saying that the idea should be the sort of amount of contentment and happiness you had divided by ecological footprint.
Yes, very
and that
good.
That is almost precisely what the Happy Planet Index does. Mm. It takes a nation's output as its happy and long lives, and it divides it by its ecological footprint. It's not quite exactly statistically that, because there's a little bit of jiggery-pokery so that you don't get a quite... It is basically that.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what we think it is. It's how much well-being do you get for your resource use, your bang for your buck, you know, your miles per gallon is your well-being per your resource use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Fawn, very much for your call. Vicky from Duluth, this is an email, wonders if both of you are familiar, you will be soon if you're not, because you'll be in Madison, with the work of Dr. Richard Davidson. His study of happiness and brain activity, his work revealed that a group of monks, many of them have been coming to Madison for some years now, were most happy they had more left brain activity.
Yeah, I've met Richard a couple of times. I didn't actually know he was from Wisconsin. I apologize about that. But his work is exceptionally interesting. So he put these Buddhist monks in a brain scan, and statistically we talk about how many standard deviations someone is from the mean. And the monks were about 3 standard deviations above the mean for their brain activity, which is basically an impossible result, which means that somehow this training in mindfulness and meditation is affecting their brain functioning in a very positive way, in a calming way. So he's really at the cutting edge of this research and is a fascinating guy to speak with. Have you met him, Jen?
Actually, I haven't met him yet, but I know the study that you're talking about. But yeah.
Well, I hope he's listening. We've had him on the show several times. He's a fascinating man, and I'm sure that somebody in Madison can get word to him that the two of you would like to meet him if he's around during the time that you're in Madison, because it would behoove both of you to see what's going on with him, certainly. And he's doing phenomenal work with returning veterans and just really interesting post-traumatic stress work, and he's a good man in the field. Earl in Medford is a caller for you both. Hi, Earl.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to nominate dogs as being inimical to our happiness at all times. And this has been going on for many, many, many years, this positive end on both ends. They've discovered that, say, your blood pressure will go down while you're petting the dog, but the dog's blood pressure will also go down. And our dog, our husky, has been waiting out patiently on the front, waiting for me to finish this so we can go for a midday walk.
Earl.
We both really enjoy it. We both got through this severe winter with each other.
Oh, I'm all for dogs. I'm with you. I think dogs ought to be all over the workplace. And I'm for dogs. What about animals? What about happiness in animals? How do you figure those in any way, Jen?
That's interesting in the sense of doing in a workplace. I guess it really depends on the kind of workplace that you have. I think as an example, in California, in Northern California, having dogs around the workplace is probably, people don't think twice. But then I think in other sort of environments, it can be a little sticky or controversial. So it really comes back down to that particular company and its particular company culture. And that's what we really say and think is in this. The thought is that we're not asking people to be like a Zappos or be like any other company for that matter. What we really want to encourage is for that company to be unique to their own DNA and their values and their beliefs. And that engaging, by that being able to engage their employees in what their higher purpose is. So dogs could be definitely part of the picture. We encourage anything that, has that positive affirmation. But, I mean, a huge part of it is engagement between human and human. And more research is showing that, there's mirror neurons in our bodies that react in positive ways once we see it in another person. So that whole saying of happiness is contagious is not really just a saying. It's actually scientifically proven.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know if you like dogs, Nick, but which would you rather have, a fancy car or a loyal dog you could bring to work every day?
I'd be with the dog every time. And
me too.
There's definitely research around pets keeping people mm-hmm. company, fighting loneliness and depression. And I've looked at the studies, which is in local areas of the UK. And if you ask older people if they've got a pet, then they tend to be much happier than those that don't have a pet. Mm-hmm. So, and particularly, I think dogs have co-evolved with humans over millennia, actually, and our emotions are quite tuned. And I know that dogs are one of the few creatures that if you point, they will look to where you're pointing to rather than your finger. Most other things would look at your finger. The dog actually understands you're pointing to something. So there is something about our relationship with dogs which is relatively unusual. Amongst other species, yeah.
I'm wondering, Nick, about world leaders and how many have been sitting down, if any, to look at the very thing that you're talking about, because this has to come from governments, I would imagine, as well as from people who live in certain countries. Is this becoming something that's catching fire?
It's definitely something that is absolutely on the rise. I mean, I've been working in alternative indicators to GDP since the early 90s, so for 20 years now. And when I started out, you had to shout very loud for anyone to notice, and things have changed so much in the last 8-10 years. And so the UK government actually has a national indicator of well-being. It's the first Western government to have an indicator of well-being. And it's, you know, it's run by the Office of National Statistics, and they're starting to learn how to use it. And we see lots of other things going on in the European Union. There's a whole trend. It's called Beyond GDP, and more recently creating indicators beyond alternative to GDP. So there's lots and lots of things. The OECD have a very interesting set of measures, of new measures of progress. So there's a lot going on. I mean, famously, Bhutan have a gross national happiness indicator rather than a gross national product. So that there's a lot of stuff going on. I think it would be naive to think that this is mainstream yet, but it's happening. There's definitely investment in it. There's definitely interest in it. It will take 10 years, 15 years to start really gaining momentum. The ex-president of France, President Sarkozy, had a commission which Joseph Stiglitz, who's a U.S. winning Nobel Prize winner, led. It became known as the Stiglitz Commission. So there's a lot of stuff going on. It's still not mainstream. Still a lot of work to go, but there's progress on it.
Mm-hmm. And Jen, what about, I don't know what companies you've worked with, probably many of them you've advised, but what about companies and heads of companies? Is there a movement to determine what the well-being of employees is and how to achieve happiness or contentment, a sense of fulfillment among employees?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, especially in the last few years, this idea is reaching to, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, C-levels and executives, because I think there's been a dawning of on their own lives. I think a lot of people that are reaching out to us might have, you know, gone through their whole lives and realized that they were working for their resume the whole time and looking back and not understanding what that was all for. So in some ways it's selfish because of a reflection on their own lives. In some ways, they are realizing that it just makes economic sense to, in order to really sustain a company these days, it's not really about talking about millennials versus baby boomers anymore. It's really about how do we connect and make a underlying foundation that people can all gravitate towards, a universal way. So in the sense of the realization that if you can create this environment where you're actually making your employees happier, then your customers will actually be happier naturally. And then that's when the business results with profitability and productivity actually show up. So
yeah.
You know, it's kind of a win-win-win for all. And I think the realization is settling in.
So take into account then and how companies go about changing this, how countries go about changing this. We've done show after show after show, and I'm sure both of you are extremely aware of wealth gap, inequality gap, particularly in the United States, but it's elsewhere too, but we're really egregious in this regard. So you have a whole lot of people who are making so much money, you can't even imagine what it's like to make that much money or what in the world you're going to do with it in your lifetime, and a whole lot of other people who are struggling, sometimes two or three jobs to get by and having a very difficult time of it. Not that the very rich people are any happier than the people who are on the bottom, but how do you take into account that particular factor in trying to achieve contentment among all? Nick?
I think that, you know, income inequality is one of the great shames of our, something that should shame us in modern society, you know. And you know, I'm actually sitting right now in one of the more equal nations in the world, Norway, and they make a lot of efforts to have policies around the redistribution of income. They make a lot of effort to make sure that no child is left behind. That, you know, that just because your parents left school at 16, you've actually got full chance to go to college. And you know, you try not to get these. They try very hard not to get these intergenerational inequalities to sort of remain. So there's a lot to be done about that. And actually, if you look at the statistics, you know, in a hard way, then actually what differentiates the happiness in the USA from, say, Nordic countries like Norway, Sweden, Denmark, is not the richest people or even the average person. It's the bottom 20-40% of the population in terms of income, in that poor people in the USA are much less happy than the poorer populations in Norway, Denmark, Sweden. And that's because of the social safety nets, and that's because of the fact there's not such a gap between the rich and the poor in these countries. So I think if you're going to take one big national policy to increase happiness, then it would be about inequality and access to work, in that, you know, long-term unemployment is dreadful for people's self-esteem, their sense of purpose, their relationships, their dignity, things much further than the sheer economic poverty of it. In fact, from a statistical perspective, the effects on happiness are three times as large than just can be explained by the loss of income. So there's lots of other factors going on there, and it would be the one thing that government should really, really address.
Yeah, interesting. We'll welcome more phone calls. We'll say goodbye to Jen and look forward to seeing her in Madison next week. Nick staying with us the remainder of the hour. Jen is CEO and Chief Happiness Officer of Delivering Happiness, culture book creator and consultant at Zappos and many, many other companies. And Nick Marks should be a consultant to many countries. He has done all kinds of work on our unhappiness and tying it to planetary well-being as well. So when it comes to happiness being determined by wealth, love, and health, wealth is way at the bottom. He believes that they don't need to measure that because people should be happy and the planet should be happy. And so how do we achieve that? And they do an index of happy countries and found, this isn't giving it away now, that Costa Rica is the happiest nation of the planet. Life expectancy, the same as the United States. Huge percentage of resources, electricity coming from renewable resources, a pledge to be carbon neutral pretty soon, abolishing the army, investing in social problems programs. Not that it's utopia, because it's not. They have their own set of problems, but maybe we should be looking at Latin America. What do you think? Two more phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we continue our conversation with Nick. Let's go next to Jabril in Milwaukee. Hi, Jabril.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I was just listening to the broadcast, and I heard Earl talking, you know, about how when you're petting a dog, you know, it's not only good for you but the dog. And it occurred to me, you know, I don't think it's just the dog. You know, I think there have been studies done that when people, you know, have contact with other human beings, that's good. You know, mm-hmm. Giving a hug can release certain endorphins in the body that are good for us at a certain level. And I think that's something that we don't engage in enough, you know, connecting with other people through either conversation or contact. I think something, you know, Nick said too, I believe that's the name of your guest, correct?
Yes, it is.
You know, when he was talking about some of those Eastern European countries, I think the impression that I have is that they're very community-based countries as well. And not that there just isn't a big gap, but that there's, more interaction between people. And, you know, I think that's something that in the United States, we have a very individualistic culture, and I think if we started caring more about other people, we'd all be a little bit more happy.
Oh, I think you make some excellent points, and I think you'll agree, Nick.
Yeah, I would agree with, you know, nearly everything there, and I mean, relationships are really the biggest driver of our happiness. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are relational beings. We're actually, all of us, you know, we're actually created through a relationship between our parents. And we're brought up in a network of relationships, you know, our families, our schools, our communities. And they are the fundamental driver of our happiness. I mean, so Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, actually, he won the Nobel Prize for economics. But, he says that, you know, it wouldn't be too far to say that the definition of happiness is good relationships. And happiness itself is a social emotion. So if we laugh on our own, walking down a road laughing by ourselves, we'd look slightly crazy. you know, but if we're with other people, it's the most natural thing in the world. So shared experiences, yeah, you know, and that can be with a dog too, you know, but the shared experience is the most rewarding experience. So I often talk about the fact that there's five ways to happiness, and the first of those and the most important is connect, and the second is be active, the third is take notice, which is sort of around mindfulness and reflection. The fourth is to keep learning. And the fifth, again, is social, is give, mm-hmm. which is actually when we give to other people, then actually we feel good too. So, we're so much in a web of relationships of our happiness that's crucial. And there's definitely lots of research that touch is really important. You know, if you're in a relationship with somebody and, you know, maybe it's going through a rocky time, touch is a really strong way out of it. And it, communicating to each other, both with words and with touch, is really, really important.
Hmm. Anything else, Jabril?
No, I just think, you know, if you see someone on the, you know, you're walking by, maybe, you know, ask them a question, care about them a little bit, mm-hmm. maybe even give them a hug. It'll probably be good for you and for them.
I think
you might have to ask before you give them the hug.
What did you say before the hug?
You might need to ask before you give them
right.
the hug.
That's true. Unless it's somebody you know.
Yeah.
And you know they'll welcome it. Thank you so much, Jabril, for the call. And part of, you know, it's interesting that was wide-ranging, those advice tips that you gave us, this thing that you got to put yourself in a positive mood, a happier mood. There are some basic things that you need to do, and you need to move. You suggest that we dance, that we go for a walk, that it does something to the body, and it makes you feel better.
It definitely does. I mean, one of the things that defines emotions in human beings is that they're not just a thought; they are a bodily feeling. And the connections between the brain and the body work the other way. That if you move your body, it's going to release emotional energy too. So, you know, if we're feeling really angry about something, and sometimes it's not appropriate to direct that to the source of the anger, then going for a walk or run will shift that energy. And if we're depressed, we're down, we're sad, it's a similar thing. It's moving. And in fact, you know, a lot of us, you know, have suffered from depression or live with someone that has depression.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, one of the best ways of treating depression is movement. And it's exceptionally hard, you know, if you've lived with someone that has, you know, serious depression, to move them off the sofa, to help them off the sofa is a really hard thing to do. But if you can do and you can get them moving, it does help things. And, you know, humans aren't designed to sit all day. We are designed, you know, through our ancestral past, you know, we were running, we were walking, maybe up to about 9 or 10 miles a day, every day.
Woo.
And so movement is going to help us.
Thanks, Jabril, for your call. David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Yeah. I said four values really helps happiness. Duty, truth, freedom, and love, and they're all about relationships. Duty is appreciating the relationships in your life. Truth is knowing them. Freedom is your ability to choose them, and love is caring about them. And can you really care without choosing, or choose without caring? Same thing for the other. Can you really appreciate without knowing, or know without appreciating? And it defines life, because the difference between non-living things and living things, well, living things appreciate, they know, they choose, they care.
Yeah, I think it's really important, and I think choosing and feeling chosen, you know, the other way around is really, really important. And, you know, understanding other people and feeling understood and loving other people and feeling loved. It's a two-way street there. And I think that, you know, they are really, really important factors in our life. Yeah.
You make mention in your TED Talk, and I have been captivated by his speech. It's what I listen to always on his day, Dr. Martin Luther King Day in this country. He talked about the eve of his death, where he gave this incredible speech of his being to the mountaintop. And you talk about his presentation of a vision of a world that he has seen and that we all need to keep in mind. Our promise of the mountaintop, being at the top of the mountaintop, and what transition it is we need to take. to get there. What is it that's so important about that last speech of Dr. King's and is relevant to what we're talking about?
You know, it's a speech that when you listen to it, just sends shivers through me, actually. I mean, he was, I think, you know, the best orator of, you know, I mean, Kennedy was pretty amazing too. But Martin Luther King, when he talks about going to the mountaintop, I think he's speaking to that sort of rising sense of purpose that we all touch in our lives sometimes. And he was articulating it, you know, so beautifully that, you know, that we have to look up and out and you know, see the best in the world. And he, you know, created a very poetic vision, like I think, you know, all spiritual and religious texts do in some senses. They help us be the best self we can be. And I think that was his calling. I mean, obviously the tragedy of his speech was that he was talking about it the night before he was shot. And so it becomes even more poignant, but it was a stunning speech and it's worth listening to.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that I've been assuming that you're coming to Madison, and I'm sorry you're not, because...
Yeah, I was going to point that out.
I know, I'm sorry. You're on video.
I mean, it's something that I struggle with is travel. You know, it takes a lot of carbonite. You do deliver a better speech when you're in person, but I wasn't able to travel to this event, but I'm doing it through video and with Q&A, yeah.
Yeah, but it would be good for you to come to see what's going on in Madison concerning contentment and happiness and brain study of all of that. I think that would be a good trip for you.
You know, I love travel, and in fact, I think it's one of the big challenges to the environmental movement is, you know, the fact that we learn so much from different cultures, and we learn so much from being with people, and you know, the ease of travel, you know, is I think a great thing in modern life, and yet it comes at a carbon cost, so that's a really hard one. You know, but these trade-offs are things that we have to deal with personally and politically, and people take different views on it. And you know, I'm well aware that we live in a time which is very mobile. And you know, I mean, I'm actually married to someone, you know, not from my locality. Most of human history, you know, we've married close kin because we haven't been able to travel. And the modern life sets up all sorts of other possibilities. So, you know, we shouldn't feel too guilty about that. And we should also try and move forward to actually how can we create a sustainable future.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to Margie in Iowa. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I'm from Iowa. I live in Illinois, but in Iowa right now. I grew up I have 10 brothers and sisters. I grew up with a very simple lifestyle and have tried to continue that. But I do live as a grown-up in a very affluent community. And I guess what I've noticed is that I think that sometimes we don't make connections because there isn't really a need for it. We have so much. We're so self-sufficient that I think when you look at communities where they don't have as much, they might initially connect out of need, but then those need-based relationships turn into, you know, mutually satisfying relationships where we affirm each other. Maybe that's already been said. I don't know. I kind of tuned in later.
It's an interesting point because it's an extraordinary times that we live in. You know, there's never been so much wealth, never so many resources available to us. And, you know, through most of human history, we've struggled for survival, and relationships have been absolutely key to that. And what is interesting is that you're quite right, is that we do become more self-sufficient. We've got more people living on their own than ever before in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we want our space. Most of our dreams around happiness about being on our own on a beach by ourselves, because life is very, very, you know, difficult, and relationships are tricky to negotiate and all sorts of things. And so we have this sort of desire, and it's just like food, I think. We have a desire for fatty, sweet food,
right?
Because what we couldn't used to get, and we become too heavy. And it's interesting, I think our drive for independence makes us too lonely, and yet the drive for independence is still there.
Yeah, and Nick, we have to say goodbye to you at that thought. It's been an inspirational hour. Thank you. Nick Marks joining us by phone from Oslo, Norway. Thanks to KP Whaley. We have more information on next week's conference on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Please go there. And thanks. And I hope we all can achieve contentment. Bring me down, I said, because I'm happy.